This is the Jesse Kelly Show.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show, final hour of the Jesse Kelly Show on our Memorial Day edition, where we honor the fallen for 3 hours. Just once more, a reminder, veterans, it's a day where you can get low if it happens, all right? If you're there, if you're low today, put the bottle down, pick up a phone. 988 is what you call, and then press 1. 988. But that's just one number. There are so many resources out there now. The only shame is not talking to somebody, okay? So if you're dwelling on your brothers that are no longer with us today and you're getting too low, reach out, okay? Reach out. And remember, look, you can always email the show, Jesse at jessekellyshow.com. Jesse at jessekellyshow.com. The first hour, we kind of did a World War II-centric thing. Then the second hour, we did Korea. This hour, we're going to do Vietnam. In just a couple minutes, I'm going to finish this list of names. These are combat training deaths, men who died in training. Captain Michael Quinn, Lance Corporal Joshua E. Barron, Lance Corporal Matthew J. Detterman, Captain Brian Kennedy, Captain Kevin Roche, Captain Brian Kennedy, Sergeant Jeffrey Sempler, Corporal Matthew Drown, Corporal Thomas Jardis, Lance Corporal Ty Hart, Captain Stephen Torbert, Major Sean Campbell, Sergeant Dylan Semolina, Sergeant William Turner, Sergeant Adam Scholler, Corporal Christopher Orlando, PFC James Beach, Major Dennis Dogs, Corporal Michael McCallick. And remember this, these training, dying in training while you're in the military, that's just as heroic, it's just as honorable as the guy who died on the beaches of Normandy. If you're a family out there today, maybe remembering a son or a daughter, husband, wife, whoever died in a training accident. No, they don't make movies about what your loved one did, but it's just as honorable and heroic. Military training is dangerous and has to be dangerous. And you die in training so that others may live, so they can work out what went wrong, and you'll never see it. They'll never come knock on your door and tell you, but people will live because of the sacrifice your loved one made in training. Period. All right? Now, let's go to Vietnam and talk about a couple Vietnam things before we check out of here this hour. First, I know a lot of this stuff will be basic, but again, you know there was North Vietnam and South Vietnam. South Vietnam, the Vietnamese who were fighting against us there, they were the guerrillas, the Viet Cong. In North Vietnam, they had the North Vietnamese Army. Regular army troops, regular uniforms, that kind of stuff. But all that man in the black pajamas talk you hear, those are guerrillas from South Vietnam, guerrilla fighters. What's a guerrilla fighter? Well, he's somebody who you look out at his field and he appears to be a farmer. He's just, oh, look at him. He's working the rice fields. And he is a farmer until you leave. Then he goes to his hut. And he digs up the AK-47 he had hidden there, and he heads out to a spider hole, and he waits in a little hole in the ground for your platoon to walk by again, where he'll snipe your best friend in the face and then go hiding right back down in that hole. He's a guerrilla fighter. He's the one putting booby traps up everywhere. He's the one recruiting other people and threatening other people in the South. Now, it's very, very, very difficult. If you're going to fight a modern war with modern sensibilities, to root out guerrilla fighters who are entrenched in the population, it's very, very difficult. Let me explain why. I'll give you the other half lives first. If you're Genghis Khan, and you have an area with a bunch of guerrilla fighters who are giving your people trouble, well, that's not that big of a deal if you're Genghis Khan. because he doesn't have our modern sensibilities. Meaning if there's, let's say, the state of Arkansas. The state of Arkansas, the Mongols have taken over America, and the state of Arkansas, they're giving him trouble because in city after city and town after town, these frigging gorillas are making life miserable for Genghis Khan. Well, Genghis is not going to stress about that. He's just going to go kill everyone because it's a different moral code, because the human life is not as valuable. Each human life is not a unique God-breathed soul, none of that stuff. Because there's no value of human life, well, it's easy to clear out a guerrilla insurgency. Just kill them all. Men, women, children, it's fine. Kill them all. Raise the buildings to the ground. Look at that. We solved the guerrilla problem, didn't we? Everyone's dead. Problem solved. But that's not modern sensibilities. In the modern era, it's very, very, very difficult, not just for us, for any nation, to fight in an area where a significant portion of that area, they don't want you there, and they're fighting a guerrilla war against you. It's just very, very, very difficult. And empire after empire, from Britain to France to America, they've had to go through exactly this. Shoot, France went through this in Vietnam itself. It's hard when the people around you, when enough of them don't want you there and want you dead. It's a constant stress, a constant strain. Is my meal poisoned? As I walk across the street, am I going to get sniped from somewhere? It's a problem. We were dealing with how to deal with this problem in a, I really don't want to use the word humane, but we didn't want to go full Genghis Khan. But in South Vietnam, there would be areas, and many of them were hotter than others, that were just hotbeds of the Viet Cong. Picture it like there were provinces. Okay, so there's a province, and it's in South Vietnam. So technically, we're kind of on their side, except the Viet Cong are really causing us huge problems from that area because there are so many of them. We weren't sure what to do. So we began what were called search and destroy campaigns. They sound intense, and they were intense. When I say campaign, I mean it wasn't one patrol. It wasn't an afternoon. You would have a province, okay, the province of Chris in South Korea. And this province is annoying, obviously. And it has a bunch of Viet Cong guerrillas in there. And I want to clean out the province of Chris. And I'm the United States of America, so what am I going to do? What we would often do, and you can laugh at this all you want, but again, we were trying to do it humanely, kind of. We would fly overhead, and we would drop leaflets all over the place. We would tell them, hey, civilians, you might want to get out. Hey, get out now. This is a problem area. We are coming in. Get out. Just a heads up, everybody. You don't want to be here. When we come back, get out, get out, get out. And then we will begin search and destroy. Search and destroy can take the form of many things. It's a platoon walking into a village and interrogating the villagers. Hey, who's a Viet Cong? Who's not? Searching the village for weapons and food supplies. And when I say food supplies, you can tell when a village has enough food for the village. And when a village has enough food for, wait a minute, this looks like you're supporting some sort of an army unit. You look for secret weapon stashes. If you find any of these things or enough suspicious activity, well, war is an ugly thing. You start burning down the village. Refugees hit the road. During the course of our search and destroy campaigns, there were millions of refugees created by us and the Vietnamese, as again, I mean, wars fought amongst civilians, wherever they're fought, are the most horrible wars. You've seen enough pictures and video out there of just line after line after line of women and children walking up the roads with the belongings they can carry. That's all the belongings they have left in the world. And so we're burning out villages. We're running people out. We're also bombing. These search and destroy campaigns were also aerial bombing campaigns. What you're trying to clear with a search and destroy campaign is an area. It's an area-focused thing. And they last 30 days, 40 days, a sustained campaign over and over. Bombs, patrols, bombs, patrols, bombs, patrols. You're trying to clear an area out. That's a search and destroy campaign. Now, were they successful or not? Everyone can argue about this because everyone argues about everything when it comes to Vietnam. The military just started counting bodies to try to report how successful it was, because we always killed more of them than they could kill of us. We had better training, more firepower. So they'd go attack an area for 30 days, and at the end of it, they'd say, nice, we killed 2,000 of them. We lost 100 of ours. We won. Kind of. It's still a bad area, all right? So that's search and destroy. We'll read you a search and destroy citation and email recommendation next.
Jesse Kelly.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show, honoring the fallen on this Memorial Day, and kind of did World War II first hour, Korea second hour, talking about fallen troops. This hour we're going to focus more on Vietnam, was kind of just going through search and destroy missions. And you should know, before I go into this Distinguished Service Cross citation and the email someone emailed in, you should know that they were extremely nerve-wracking, very difficult campaigns for the troops themselves. Think about what a mission that is. You have to go root out guerrillas. Well, guerrilla fighters fight dirty. Why? Because they have to. You fight as dirty as you have to. So these were the campaigns where our guys would routinely be sniped. And that was such a problem in Vietnam. Sniper fire, it's always difficult. It's always horrible. But when you're in that kind of an environment, there's a lot of easy places for a sniper to hide, especially when they have holes in the ground. The booby traps were terrible. You know about punji sticks or punji pits. At least I hope you've heard of them before. They're just long, sharpened wooden stakes. And the Vietnamese would make, well, they used them in a bunch of different ways, but one of the main ways, the main way they used them, is they would simply have a pit they would dig in the ground. Call it a few feet deep, 3-4 feet deep. And they'd cover up the pit so you wouldn't know there was a pit there. And if you stepped on it, you would fall through. Well, it's not just that there were wooden sticks there. They would go number two on them. And what that did was, as you can imagine, would create basically an instant infection. And unless you have a strong stomach, I wouldn't bother looking this up. But you can look this up and see pictures of guys who have stepped on them with wooden stakes through their feet, through their legs, through their... It's debilitating. So that's one of the things they went through. Then you have to get medevaced out of there. They would have not all booby traps are made to kill you. They would put booby traps up like glass jars at eye level that won't really create enough shrapnel to kill you. But one moment you're walking with your buddies, the next moment, boom, there's an explosion and your buddy doesn't have eyes anymore. He's blind now for the rest of his life. These search and destroy missions were intense and they were very, very difficult and very difficult on the troops. And this is... Well, we got this email about a Joseph Andrew Garcia. The email said this. Jesse, I don't know if I should read his name. I probably can, but Jesse, I don't want to read his name without permission. Jesse, my name is blank. I was the combat medic in Joe's infantry platoon and was in the same firefight in which Joe was killed. A day doesn't go by that I don't see Joe in my mind's eye leaping from the irrigation ditch and charging across the road with his M14 rifle in his right hand and the Laws rocket, anti-tank rocket, in his left. Please don't misunderstand. I'm fortunate to have never suffered from post-traumatic stress. It's just that I always want to always remember that for one brief period in my life, my boots walked on the same ground. I shared jokes and drank beer with a true American hero. And without further ado, this is the American hero, Joseph Andrew Garcia's Distinguished Service Cross. The President of the United States of America, authorized by Act of Congress, July 9th, 1918, amended by Act of July 25th, 1963, takes pride in presenting the Distinguished Service Cross posthumously to Specialist Fourth Class Joseph Andrew Garcia, United States Army, for extraordinary heroism in connection with military operations involving conflict with an armed hostile force in the Republic of Vietnam while serving with Company A, 1st Battalion, 18th Infantry, 2nd Brigade, 1st Infantry Division, or 1st Infantry Division. Specialist 4 Garcia distinguished himself by exceptionally valorous actions on the 31st of January, 1968, as a member of an infantry unit conducting search and destroy operations near Tan Son Nhut Air Base. His platoon, the lead element of the company, was suddenly subjected to intense machine gun, automatic weapons, and small arms fire from an insurgent force of unknown size. Serving as point man, Specialist Garcia remained completely exposed to the ravaging enemy fusillade to provide covering fire for his comrades as they deployed in defensive positions. During the ensuing firefight, he located a Viet Cong machine gun emplacement that had inflicted several casualties to his unit. With complete disregard for his safety, Specialist Garcia armed himself with a light anti-tank weapon and crawled across an open field toward the hostile position. He was severely wounded by a burst of enemy automatic weapons fire as he maneuvered forward. Heedless of the hail of bullets continually striking around him, he fearlessly rose to one knee and fired his weapon from point-blank range at the machine gun, destroying it and killing its crew. As he fired his weapon, Specialist Garcia was mortally wounded by an enemy sniper bullet. Specialist Four Garcia's extraordinary heroism and devotion to duty at the cost of his life were in keeping with the highest traditions of military service and reflect great credit upon himself, his unit, and the United States Army. 19 years old. 19 years old died that day. Died low crawling across enemy fire so he could fire an anti-tank weapon into an enemy machine gun emplacement and stop that machine gun emplacement from killing his buddies. 19 years old. That's something we don't think about enough either, is it? Reagan talked about this once during one of his famous speeches, but it's true. The mind plays a trick on you. You picture these guys as old men, right? Because that's how we picture them. But they were kids, man. 19-year-old lions is what they were. All right, we have another one. Maybe some POW talk. Next. It is the Jesse Kelly Show on a Memorial Day. A Memorial Day where we are honoring the fallen. Remember, you can email the show if you want. Jesse@jessekellyshow.com. Jesse@jessekellyshow.com. Before we move on to this POW story, Vietnam POW. I thought as long as we're on that same search and destroy mission, now that we've kind of gone over what those were in a little way, I thought maybe we should do one more of those here. This is for a Julius Maddox, U.S. Army, Distinguished Service Cross. The President of the United States of America, authorized by Act of Congress, July 9, 1918, takes pride in presenting the Distinguished Service Cross posthumously to Private First Class Julius Maddox, United States Army, for extraordinary heroism in connection with military operations involving conflict with an armed hostile force in the Republic of Vietnam while serving with the Headquarters Company, 1st Battalion, 14th Infantry, 4th Infantry Division. Private First Class Maddox distinguished himself by exceptionally valorous actions on the 6th of February, 1968 as medical aid man of an infantry company on a search and destroy operation near Hoi An. While crossing an open, dry rice paddy, his unit was hit by devastating fire from enemy soldiers entrenched in camouflaged positions within 2 meters of the friendly forces. Golly. The ravaging small arms and machine gun barrage killed or wounded many of the men in his platoon during the initial moments of the ambush, and the remainder of the friendly force withdrew to concealment offered by a nearby cane field. With complete disregard for his welfare, Private Maddox sprinted across the bare terrain under a hail of fire to reach a wounded comrade and carry him to safety. Seeing a fellow medic hit, he returned through enemy withering enemy machine gun fire to move the man to a helicopter evacuation landing zone. When the rescue ships arrived, he placed his patients aboard, secured a litter from one of the crews, and returned to aid soldiers still trapped in the deadly killing zone. He was shot in both legs by North Vietnamese fire, but ignored his wounds to carry another casualty to the waiting aircraft. He was urged to board the helicopter for evacuation, but he refused any aid for himself and returned to rescue more wounded. Only when he was certain that all his injured comrades were safe did he allow treatment and evacuation for himself. His courageous and selfless action in the heat of battle were directly responsible for saving the lives of several fellow soldiers. Private First Class Maddox's extraordinary heroism and devotion to duty were in keeping with the highest traditions of military service and reflect great credit upon himself, his unit, in the United States Army. And he was killed in action 16 days after that. Again, like I've explained, we read Medal of Honor's citations every single Monday as part of our Medal of Honor Monday. But those aren't the only awards for valor. And you read through these other awards for valor and you say to yourself, how does that guy not get a Medal of Honor? The dude just keeps charging into the teeth of an ambush to pick people up and carry them to safety, including being shot in both legs and still carrying them to safety and refusing to be evacuated. Not that there's anything wrong with the Distinguished Service Cross, mind you, but how in the world is that not a Medal of Honor? What has a guy got to do for a Medal of Honor around these parts? Which brings me to the final part of our show today on Medal of Honor Monday, POWs. We talked about POWs briefly in the beginning when it came to Japan and the Pacific portion of that war. But POWs in general, it's a difficult conversation to have. It's always a difficult conversation to have because when you're a family member of a POW, what's going through your head? Is there anything worse? If your son is, he's not killed by the Taliban in Afghanistan, he's captured by the Taliban in Afghanistan. Do you ever sleep again as a parent? Wondering what your child is going through? Wondering, what are they doing to him? Is he already dead? Are they torturing him? Is he suffering from disease? So the POWs, they don't get, I shouldn't say they don't get enough credit because we do honor POWs a lot. But POWs, especially in these conflicts where you're facing a power who doesn't believe in any kind of ethical treatment for POWs, it's something. Now let's discuss some Air Force things when it comes to Vietnam. We had these planes called RF-4Cs, Phantoms is what they were called, but don't worry about details. Don't worry about that. What these planes were they had cameras attached to them. Daytime, nighttime, didn't matter. You would fly reconnaissance missions around to see where things are. Always remember, we take for granted, because of modern technology, we make the mistake of thinking that even today, that we just know where things are. We know, hey, I know they have this many artillery pieces here, and I know that this unit of 1,000 strong is here, and this unit of 2,000 strong is there. But even today, with all the fancy satellites and fancy spy planes, we don't know where many things are, and things get moved and things stay hidden, and you try to obfuscate where things are, Chris. No, seriously, you try to cover up where things are. Now that's with today. That's with satellite imaging from today. Go back to basically the rest of human history. Half the battle is trying to figure out where they are and how many of them are they? That again, because we read history, we always read about a battle in hindsight. We read about a battle where 100 men will take on 1,000 men. Well, the 100 men will usually take on the 1,000 men because they didn't know there were freaking 1,000 men over there. You don't know. It's not like the enemy walks around with a big billboard. We're 100 miles to the east and we outnumber you 10 to 1. That's not how it works. And when you have a country like Vietnam, with all those mountains and all those jungles and things, it's hard to get accurate information. Where is the enemy? How many are there? How much equipment does he have? What do you do? So reconnaissance was huge in Vietnam. But the problem with that is our Air Force had gotten way more modern and way better. So now we're not dealing with prop planes, propeller-powered planes. We're dealing with jet fighters now. So that's good. Well, wait, nice technology, jet fighters, except technology goes both ways. Yeah, it's a jet fighter, but now the enemy, he has surface-to-air missiles that can track your jet fighter on radar, meaning he has things on the ground, and it's, again, it's not like there's a billboard, hey, be careful of this area, there are surface-to-air missiles here, don't fly over it. You don't know until you're in the cockpit and it starts beeping at you, uh-oh, missile incoming. And the North Vietnamese Army was not ill-equipped. Now, they didn't have near our equipment, don't get me wrong, but the Soviets were helping them out with equipment. The Chinese were helping them out with equipment. And do you think, look what we're doing to Russia today, sending them tanks, sending them all these missiles and things like that. That's the same kind of thing that they were all doing in Vietnam. Do you think Russia was sitting back smiling every time a surface-to-air missile took out an American fighter jet? Of course they were. Again, this is the ugliness of the proxy war situation. All right, back to these fighter pilots. I've always viewed this as one of those really, really nerve-wracking things, but most of the pilots, virtually every military pilot I've ever known, had gigantic brass ones, so they probably just didn't think about this at all. Getting shot down in enemy territory. Specifically, getting shot down in enemy territory in a place that you have been bombing. Picture that. A place you've been bombing. Just do yourself a favor. We'll come right back and we'll finish this thought. I want you to think about your city, your town, your area being bombed. Think about that for a moment. Hang on.
The Jesse Kelly Show.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show. Final segment of this Jesse Kelly Show on a Memorial Day. And we will be back to our regularly scheduled programming tomorrow. We've always thought it was important to come do a show today, a special show today. No live ads, no nothing like that. It's just a show to honor the fallen. We get one of those a year. So that's what we're doing today. Now, back to the POW thing, because we're finishing up with our thoughts on Vietnam. Remember, part of the reason it's so brutal for pilots who get shot down. In wars that take place where civilians are, which, let's be honest, that's most wars. You don't arrange to go meet out in the countryside. Wars today are fought where civilians live. Planes drop explosives. Explosives kill people. They kill people you love. They destroy things you love. Picture this. And I'm not doing this we're the bad guy thing. That's not what I'm doing at all. I'm trying to explain why it's so dangerous for these pilots when they get shot down. Picture your town, your area, your neighborhood. What if enemy planes, Chinese planes, what if they started strafing your neighborhood? What happens the day a kid gets killed? What if it's your kid? What happens the day they drop a bomb or two in your neighborhood? What if it blows up your church on Sunday with everyone in it? What if it destroys the local school, the hospital? You see your friends, your neighbors, your family members, you see them die because of these planes, day after day after day. They're flying overhead. Now picture this moment. You're picturing that. Now picture this. The day comes, you look up, and you see one of those pilots eject out of that plane, and he is descending down to you on a parachute. What kind of a reception do you think he just might get when he hits the ground? How's he received by the family who just lost their toddler out front? Now picture American pilots in Vietnam. That's what they oftentimes went through. Oftentimes these pilots, they would be beaten to death by the villagers before the North Vietnamese or the Viet Cong could even take possession of them. They'd torture them. They'd stab them with pitchforks, knives. There are all kinds of these horrible stories of things that happened to these pilots. When they dropped in, you didn't want to be caught. But it's not just like you had to avoid the military. Dude, you had to avoid the civilians who don't appreciate having ordnance dropped on their villages. They were as dangerous as the military. Okay, so that brings us to this. We're going to read the Air Force Cross citation of a Edwin Lee Atterbury. You finally do get taken prisoner. Let's say you didn't get killed. Then you're being held prisoner in one of the various prisoner camps, or just prisons, I guess you could call them, for the POWs over there. You're not only subjected to torture pretty routinely, you're also being used as a propaganda piece, which we'll go into that in just a second. You're also struggling with disease. Your nutrition is never where it should be. Therefore, disease creeps in easier. And this is an area with disease all over the place anyway. So you're fighting malaria. You're fighting beriberi, dysentery. You're fighting so much. There's so much working against you here. Now, let's clarify something about the propaganda. For instance, this Air Force Cross citation, it was in a place, a prison camp that was known as the zoo. The zoo is what our guys called it. It was known as the zoo because there were these concrete enclosures where our guys were held. And really, the only way you could see out or anyone could see in is they had to pretty much crack the door a little and peek in like an animal. So they called it the zoo. But this place was horrific. And they would have our guys go out and they'd hand them a basketball and there'd be a basketball hoop there. And they'd take a picture of them and then they'd propagandize that out there and say, look how well we're treating it. These guys are playing hoops. When really they were just torturing all the guys an hour before. But they would routinely do things like this. This is a really, really ugly affair. Anyway, here's the Air Force Cross citation of an Edwin Lee Atterbury. The President of the United States of America, authorized by Title 9 or authorized by Title 10, Section 8742 United States Code, takes pride in presenting the Air Force Cross posthumously to Lieutenant Colonel Edwin Lee Atterbury, United States Air Force, for extraordinary heroism in military operations against an opposing force as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam from the 11th of May 1969 to the 14th of May 1969. On the 11th of May 1969, Lieutenant Colonel Atterbury escaped from the North Vietnamese prison camp known as the Zoo and was recaptured 12 hours later. He was subjected to brutal torture for confessions pertaining to camp leadership, organization, and details of his escape plans. He was last seen by other prisoners of war on the 14th of May, 1969, and the North Vietnamese later reported that Lieutenant Colonel Atterbury had died. Through his extraordinary heroism and willpower in the face of the enemy, Lieutenant Colonel Atterbury reflected the highest credit upon himself and the United States Air Force. You should know a couple details. One, we ended up recovering his body from the Vietnamese government 5 years after the fact, and I always liked that. He eventually came home. He'd been held for 646 days. When they captured him, well, what we know is one of the buddies he was captured with, we know his name. His name is Dramesi, John A. Dramesi. John was captured with him, and John lived, but they pinned him face down to a table and beat him with rubbers. They tied up, they put his ankles in irons. They tortured these guys horribly, and that's how Mr. Edwin Lee Atterbury met his end, and that's what he did on behalf of this nation. So that's why we did a Medal of Honor or a Memorial Day show the way we did it today. To honor people, honor the fallen, honor the Atterburys, the POWs, any veterans of any war ever, any veterans of any military service, whether you died or whether you died in training or in combat, we honor you a great deal. God bless you. God bless your families today. That's all.